This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 61 was recorded May 4th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. We've got a fantastic show lined up for you. Big news in crude oil this week. And we're bringing back one of our most popular guests ever. Professor Steve Keen heads up the economics department at Kingston University in London. And he's probably best known for having accurately predicted the 2008 financial crisis, writing about exactly what was going to happen and why well before it occurred. I'd like to point out that Professor Keen's past interviews on Macro Voices are probably as relevant today as the day they were first recorded. So if you enjoy this interview today, I encourage you to go back and listen to Professor Keen's prior interviews with us, which you can find on our homepage at macrovoices.com. The subject matter is different. Today we'll be discussing the question, can we avoid another financial crisis, which happens to be the title of Professor Keen's latest book.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. But before we dive into the market wrap today, I just wanted to mention that we taped this show a couple hours earlier than usual this week. So our commentary won't include anything that happened after 2 p.m. on Thursday. So Eric, finally, the currencies and commodities are moving, but not so much on the S&P 500. We continue to trade around this 381 level on the S&P futures. What's your thinking here on the S&P?
Well, we're definitely still flirting with all-time highs, just 20 points off of the all-time highs, and plenty of bleak news flow that has happened in the last week. And as you say, commodities rolling over, breaking down below key moving averages. We'll talk more about that when we get to crude oil. These are sending a deflationary signal. So what I've been saying in the past is, hey, all these guys that are saying, this is the top, it's all over from here, what were they basing that on other than the market seems overvalued? And frankly, it seemed overvalued to me for more than a year now. Well, now we're starting to see some signals that could be confirming a change of the tide. But I don't think that that necessarily is conclusive. I won't be surprised if we see another upside breakout here. I do think that this story is going to end very badly for the bulls eventually. But, you know, as I've said before, I wanted to short tech stocks in 1999. I was correct in my analysis that they were in a bubble and overvalued. But, you know, that crazy bubble went on for another year and another 50 to 100% before it finally burst. So, I'm happy, as I've said before, to be on the sidelines right now, and I think that we are in the crazy phase, the late stages of this bull market, but who knows? I've been early with a lot of my past calls.
All right, Eric. Now let's move on to that U.S. dollar index. Now, we actually had a bit of a breakout in the euro in going right before the French elections, which continues to drag the dollar index still below this 99 handle. What's your thinking on the dollar index here?
Well, you know, even in the face of some hawkish rumors of more rate hikes being on deck from the Fed, we're still down here flirting with a 98 handle. So I still have a medium-term bullish view on the U.S. dollar. I think there's a lot of reasons that the rally is set to eventually resume in earnest. But in the short term, that view's just not working, and the chart looks a little bit ugly here. So I'm happy to sit out a couple of dances, as Julian Brigden put it on this program so eloquently a few weeks ago.
All right, Eric, let's move on to crude oil, because that's where all the real action is, and I'm sure everyone wants to hear your opinion. Obviously, crude oil just it keeps dropping. Like right now, just after 2 p.m. Eastern, we're trading around the 45-40 level on crude. What's your thinking here, where we're going next?
Well, I said this morning that I thought we were going to take out 47, and I said I thought the selling would accelerate after we got through that support at 47. Well, boy, that was the understatement of the century. What has happened is exactly what we've predicted for more than a month on this program. I said that we would find some support at the 200-day moving average, right around $49, then a little bit more support at 47. Once that broke down, I thought we were headed towards a 44 handle. I didn't think we were going to get to a 44 handle today, but boy, as you say, about 20 minutes after 2 o'clock as we're taping this segment, we're very rapidly rapidly approaching that. As you say, we're just broke below 45 spot 30 as we've been speaking in the last couple of sentences. So who knows how far this is going to go. The inventory was just the catalyst. Crude oil was a drawdown of 930,000 barrels nationwide. It should be a bigger drawdown. This is the time of year after spring maintenance is over. We're coming into summer driving season. Now, it doesn't feel like it. It's only May, but you have to realize that the gasoline that will be sold Memorial Day weekend, the traditional beginning of summer driving season, that's going to be refined from crude oil that's already been purchased by the refineries. So from a refining perspective, we're already into summer driving season. So 930,000 barrel drawdown nationwide is too small for this time of year. 728,000 barrel drawdown in Cushing, Oklahoma is too small for this time of year. How much a drawdown in gasoline? None. Build of 191,000 barrels. Not a huge build, but a build just the same at a time when we would be expecting drawdowns. Still, it's drawing down 562,000 barrels. So the big story, I think, is the breakdown below the 200-day moving average, which was right around $49. Now, 200-day moving average is a big deal in crude oil. And we had a suggestion from one of our listeners that we include a chart book with our market wrap. So we're not ready to do that completely, but we do have one chart for the crude oil market. You can find the link in your research roundup email. So I recommend that you go ahead and download that and you can refer to it as we go through this commentary. You see on this chart, which goes back 3 years, that the last time we had a breakdown below the 200-day moving average, because crude oil tends to stay on one side of the 200-day or the other, and once it crosses, it usually doesn't go back. So the last major breakdown was August 1st of 2014. That was then followed on September 2nd of 2014 by a death cross, which is where the 50-day moving average crosses down below the 200-day moving average. And that, of course, was just before the epic move down to $26. We came back above the 200-day moving average on April 12th of 2016. That was confirmed a few weeks later on May 10th of 2016 by a golden cross. That's where the 50-day moves above the 200-day. It's basically stayed above there ever since. So for just about a year now, we've been trading above the 200-day moving average. There were three prior tests. Those are the yellow ovals on the chart. Those show that there were attempts to break down below the 200-day, but they only lasted a couple of days. The record was 4 days set back in March just this year. And boy, you look at the magnitude of this one today. What you see on that chart is not even the full move because that was captured at noon or so. We were still at $46. We're coming up on $45 here. The move from $47 down to $46 took less than 3 hours today, and I think the move from 46 down to 45, if we get there, is only going to be a few hours as well. So we're seeing that things are accelerating dramatically as we've decisively taken out that moving average. Now, I won't be at all surprised if we see some kind of a retracement from here, a bounce, because there was a lot of panicking today. There's a lot of emotion in this market, and I wouldn't be surprised if we see a bounce. But, you know, I think we're headed to that 44 handle, which is my next target. When I started putting my notes together this morning for this segment, I thought, boy, 44 handle, that's a really profound, big, claim to make. People will think I'm crazy. Well, here we are a few hours later, and we're only 35 cents away from that right now, 45 spot 32 as we're speaking. So I think we are headed there. The thing is, figuring out that this was going to happen, frankly, was pretty easy. We were at $55, I think, and I made the call in this show that we were headed down below 45, and that's exactly what's happened. We're almost to 45. Now it gets much harder. Are we going to see a further drop from here to 35? That's a much harder call. I've been following a guy named Alistair Williamson, Stockboard Asset, on Twitter. He put a great Periscope video today. I don't want to go any longer on crude oil in this segment because we've already beaten it to death. But if you want more perspective, I recommend that you look at Alistair's video, which he put together today. We have a link for that in your Research Roundup email, or you can follow Stockboard Asset on Twitter.
All right, Eric, let's talk about gold. Now, traditionally, we have seen gold have a reciprocal kind of move to the U.S. dollar. But for some reason, over the last couple of weeks, we've seen this simultaneous thing where the U.S. dollar index is selling and gold is selling at the same time. And we've now made a key breakdown down to the under the 1230 level on gold. What's your thinking here?
Well, as I've said in past shows, I think what's going on is although there should be that relationship to the dollar index, there is a stronger correlation to people's fear about geopolitical escalation. And, you know, North Korea hasn't launched any nuclear missiles yet. It appears so far, at least, that the deterrence of sort of having the U.S. aircraft carrier off their shores is starting to, you know, the rhetoric is still there, but I don't see any real aggressive action in the last few days. Meanwhile, I think the fear that the Syrian situation could escalate into war between the United States and Russia is starting to abate. Now, there's still risk there, but it's not as much of a panic as we had a couple of weeks ago. My call a few weeks ago was I think that we were probably going to see, as that geopolitical fear came out of the system, a pullback in gold to 1220 or so. Well, we almost got there today. We hit 1225. So we're basically into that target range that I described. It's starting to look attractive here, but hang on. Look at the CRB index breaking down below its 50-week moving average. Alistair covered that in the video that I mentioned earlier. Look at broader commodity indices. Look last night at, I believe, iron ore actually traded limit down at one point overnight in China. There, we're seeing a lot of across-the-board weakness in commodities, sign of a deflation signal. That could spell further weakness for gold. We had a listener question that I received this week, which is, hey, I've said very many times that I'm long-term very bullish on gold, but I'm not buying it. So why not if I'm long-term bullish? And the answer is I do this all day long. I run a fund. I sit in front of the screen all day, and I'm able to afford to focus on a shorter time horizon. If I was a retail investor and only had time to think about the markets once or twice a week, I would be buying and holding gold because I think it is a good long-term investment. I think it is likely to move to all-time new highs in the next few years. The thing is, I do have the time to sit and watch the market all day. I'll admit that I may have missed an opportunity at 1125 when I had originally thought might be a buying opportunity. I'm going to wait this one out a little bit longer. And if I were in a different circumstance, if I was a retail investor and didn't have any gold, I would buy some and I would start buying the dips and accumulating it slowly. But I would only do that to the extent that I was going to be comfortable with the size of my position, that, hey, if it dips down to 1,000 before this is over, before it finally starts moving up, I won't panic. I won't freak out. I'll just take advantage of the opportunity to buy more.
All right. Well, Eric, I want to talk to you also about these 10-year treasury yields. All week, we've been hovering around this 230 level. And then just today, we've crawled up to about the 236 as interest rates are rising here. Where do you think the 10-year yield goes from here?
Well, we are climbing back up a little bit. 235 is still just a little ways off of the lows that we were seeing in the low 220s a couple weeks ago. I think that if I look at this rollover in commodities, it really makes me think that more deflation is coming, maybe recession is coming, and that lower yields are coming. So I don't know that for sure, but I'm still leaning towards lower yields, not long term. I mean, obviously, this 35-year bond bull market has to end somewhere. Did it end last summer at the 1.35 or whatever the low print and yield was? I don't know, maybe we're headed below that, but at some point you're going to want to be short treasuries. I'm not ready to do that yet. I think that we probably have another treasury rally coming before this is over, especially if the stock market rolls over and we head into recession. There's going to be a lot of flight capital moving out of stocks into bonds.
Thanks, Eric. Let's move on to our featured interview. Now, Professor Keane is head of economics department at Kingston University in London. Eric's interview with Professor Keane is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Professor Steve Keen. Steve is, of course, professor of economics at Kingston University in London. Steve's also been probably one of the most prolific and popular guests that we've had in the program. So if you enjoy today's interview, I strongly recommend that you go back. Steve's been, I think, either two or three times on the program before, and those interviews are as relevant today as they were when they were recorded. So, Steve, I think we should start with the French elections, because that's been on everybody's mind, and you certainly are in the right neck of the woods to cover that. Well, how do you see both the situation with the first election going the way that it did, and probably more importantly, in terms of the follow-on, how does this frame the overall picture of European contagion risk? You know, are we still looking at Brexit having been the beginning of the end for the EU, or would a Macron victory maybe suggest that things are coming back together?
No, I think Macron is just a continuation of Hollande by another name, and somebody who actually supports neoliberal economic policies rather than being forced to do them, as Hollande was done by the European Union and its Maastricht Treaty rules. Whatever, you know, because the issues are still there with the euro, hobbling France, all the policies, the limitations on government deficits, the attempt to cut spending with austerity and so on. And when you attempt to save at that level, every dollar you save is actually a dollar less in GDP, because a dollar less expenditure is a dollar less income. So it's totally counterproductive policies, because Macron's likely to follow those policies and actually enhance them with his ideas to sack large numbers of public servants and try to balance the budget even faster. He'll simply amplify the support for Le Pen at the next election if she loses the runoff election. And of course, that's still not necessarily a given, because even though the polls called this election very accurately, the next one depends upon who turns up to vote for their less unpopular candidate. And the only if Le Pen is guaranteed to have her full support continued, there's no necessary guarantee that Macron is going to pull support either from the centre right or the centre to extreme left. And he needs to do that to beat Le Pen in the next round. So, but if he doesn't, she'll be back in 5 years' time stronger than ever.
And how do you feel about the prospects for the European Union in general?
Oh, it was. I always describe it as a suicide pact written by the leaders of Europe when they first signed off on the Maastricht Treaty. It's a question of how long the suicide takes and what the weapon is going to be for self-destruction. Will it be France? Will it be Italy? And could it even be Germany? Because there are so many German, very conservative savers who find they're getting zero returns, and they're blaming it on the euro, and quite rightly so. So it's quite possible one of those three factions, the rising right in Germany or any group in France or Italy, and particularly in Italy, the five-star movement, that could be enough to bring the euro unstuck. And it simply has to go. The ideal of the European Union is wonderful. The execution has been almost the opposite of the ideal.
And where do you see the U.S. dollar going from here? A lot of people are starting to say, okay, this is it. The rally's over. U.S. dollar's, you know, going to roll over and watch out. 90 is next. Are we seeing the end of the dollar rally, or is this just a pause that's set to resume?
Oh, I think I don't like calling short-term movements in the currency, but the strengthening of the euro, because people saw Le Pen probably being defeated in the next round, there's certainly going to be room for volatility on that play when the second round occurs. But my feeling is that once it's obvious, let's say Macron does win, once that happens, the euro is going to weaken. If Le Pen wins, the euro is going to crash. So I'd be getting ready to short the euro after. Not that I'm going to speculate in currencies, by the way, but if I was, my position would be expecting the euro to fall shortly after the election. It could rise for a while with Macron, but once the realization set in that his policies were not going to save France, they're going to actually continue pushing it further down the euro hole, then the euro is going to start declining once more.
And U.S. equity market, we are looking, we should probably let our listeners know that we recorded this interview several days early, so we may not have the latest data, but we're still just fighting with the previous high of 2,400 on the S&P. Looks like Donald Trump's tax plan may be the catalyst to push us even to new all-time highs. Do you see this equity market continuing, or are we getting to the point where maybe we're running out of steam here?
Well, the equity market's been powered by quantitative easing until Donald came along, once becoming powered by Donald easing. Now, it's massively overvalued in any historical trend. If you take a look at Shiller's lagging price to earnings ratio, the level of the S&P right now has only got two periods where it's been exceeded. One is the rally, the enormous bubble we now know the 2000 rally was, when the PE hit almost 45 to 1. It's currently 29.41 to 1. And that is almost exactly equal with the only other peak that stands out, which is Black Tuesday in 1929. It's that level of overvaluation. But it will continue so long as QE continues. Now, if the Donald rally goes on for a bit longer because of that huge boost to after-tax revenue for American corporations, but the Reserve then tries to tuck QE out, I see QE as a pact with the devil, a bit of a Faustian bargain. You can't not continue doing it. If they do pull out, I think the market will fall because of that, regardless of what the Trump rally does. So we're going to see massive volatility as the Fed tries to extricate itself from a deal it really can't leave.
Let's move on to the U.S. Treasury market and fixed income in general. A lot of notable people have suggested that the 35-year bond bull market is over, ended last summer, and that it's all uphill from here in yield. But, of course, in the last few weeks, we've seen what is certainly at least a pullback in yields, if nothing else. How do you see this? Are we looking at a structural end to the bull market in bonds, or are we just taking a pause here as well?
I think we're just taking a pause because, again, what's actually driven the decline in yields, which, of course, increases the value of the bonds, is the rising level of private debt, meaning that the world economy simply can't tolerate anything much above a zero rate of interest. And this is what the Federal Reserve itself does not realize because it's swallowed the neoclassical blue pill. It still believes the delusional world of neoclassical economics in which you can completely ignore the private sector level of debt that's irrelevant to macroeconomics in their little matrix world. Now, when you know that it actually is a crucial indicator, then with the debt as high as it is now, any increase in yields is going to make a lot of people unable to service the debts they've currently got, certainly mean they won't continue borrowing money, so credit demand will evaporate once more and you'll fall back into a slump again. So I think the only real, I wouldn't see it as a secular shift, I'd say it's the proof that America, after the financial crisis, has turned Japanese, and I expect very much a Japanese-style history for the bond market from now on.
And so that would mean what specifically? We're looking at decades of economic stagnation, slow growth, and very low interest rates?
Yeah, until such time as we get a serious political shift, similar in the sense to what we're seeing and happening in Europe under the euro. And Donald Trump is clearly not that shift as people thought he might be. Start putting rates up because the Federal Reserve believes in its own little deluded head that the rate of interest should be 4%. That's their target because they believe that there are three magic numbers for the economy, a 2% rate of inflation, a 3% rate of economic growth, and a 4% reserve rate of interest. And that's what they're trying to target back to. And as they head back in that direction, every step they take towards that level will mean that there's more likely to be an end to the credit-based rally that's taking place in the States right now. And when that's done, that is effectively back down again to dropping rates and yields falling and bond prices rising once more. And that's a sequence I see them going through indefinitely because they still don't understand what actually drives the economy.
Well, on the subject of private debt, I know you've done a tremendous amount of work on that subject. How do you see this playing out? Because while you and I and many of our listeners agree that we have way too much private debt and that's the real problem, it seems like nobody who's pulling the strings gets it. If you look, Fannie Mae just announced that they're going to institute new innovative rules to make it possible for lenders to ignore overburdened student loan debt and be able to issue loans that they should not have issued otherwise if they were considering the actual facts. This is the government policy era that we live in. So it looks like this growth of private debt, meanwhile, margin interest is at record highs and growing. We're seeing retail coming back into the stock market and buying on leverage. The private debt continues to just be out of control. But how does this eventually end? What is the eventual event or mechanism that causes this to all unwind? And how does it look?
Well, to me, the mechanism is the government finally learning how capitalism operates, but as long as they're listening to the neoclassicals, they'll never understand that. So what I see happening is effectively imagine that there's the debt ceiling in America is actually a serious and real one, and that's the private debt ceiling. And you put that at 170% of GDP, because that's the peak level that was reached back in 2010. It's since fallen to 150%. It's now rising, 145%, I think. It's now rising. It's back up to about 150% once more. But the closer it gets to that ceiling, the less momentum it has, and therefore you can go from rising debt to reaching a peak and then falling back down again. And when that decline in the rate of growth of debt occurs, that's a decline in credit. Demand will evaporate, and all the confidence that the economy is recovering will disappear from the legislators and the regulators. They will then start dropping rates rather than raising them. So this is the game that Japan's been playing with itself for 15 years. That's a very unintentional pun, but I'll let it hang in the air there. I think the Americans are going to do the same thing. And if I look at the credit dynamics for America right now, I'm just looking at one of the charts on my Prof. Steve Keen website, where I've got all the charts from my new book up there, plus a few others. The peak level of credit, which is change in private debt in America, occurred in 2008. That was 15% of GDP. It fell to -5% in 2010. It's now hit 7%, but if you look at the data, it's starting to turn back down to negative again, or rather declining once more. So it's never going to reach the level of credit demand that occurred before the crisis, and you'll continue fluctuating up and down with a policy being driven in the opposite direction and not quite knowing why they're reversing, but being forced to by circumstances.
Steve, I want to move on to some of the geopolitical risks that are growing around the world. Why don't we start with the North Korean situation? You know, obviously this guy is threatening the United States openly and alluding to preemptive nuclear strikes. A lot of people would like to think that they're not capable of doing that, but of course they are doing missile launches and tests. What does this mean for financial markets? What are the potential risks, and where do you see the situation with North Korea going?
Oh, North Korea's always been doing this. It's always been belligerent and blustering, and it's a bit like the smallest guy in the class throwing a temper tantrum every time the bully comes anywhere near him to tell the bully to back off. Get too close, I'll smash your kneecaps in. And that's pretty much what's being said to America for the last 40 years. The sensible thing is the bullies normally thought if I throw a punch in this guy, obviously I'll win, but he might actually break my kneecap before that happens, so I will back off. Trump doesn't seem to understand that. So it does scare me that we could actually see something preemptive occurring. I don't think it will. I think that all the limitations that are set there in terms of when you can declare, I think, DEFCON 3 before you can actually launch a nuclear strike, that rules out, I hope, preemptive recognition by Trump. On the other side, with our little North Korean hairdo man, equally, this is just the usual tactic. Be belligerent, threaten Armageddon to maintain your domestic control. I think the best thing you can do to understand this is go and get a copy of 1984 and read what was being said by the various, the three parts of the world, all the bluster they would do to maintain a power without actually having to go to war with each other. So I hope that's what's happened in that situation. It'll just become a sideshow. But because every time he increases the range with which he can throw a missile or throw a weapon, then the more likely it is Americans might try something foolish like a preemptive strike. Because from everything I understand about North Korea's military capacity and the distance to Seoul, it could do it would certainly wound very, very heavily. It really would break that kneecap.
I agree with you completely, and I hope that it stays the sideshow that we want it to be. I'll tell you, though, the one that concerns me more is the risk of the Syrian situation escalating to the point where it becomes a U.S.-Russia conflict. And I'm shocked by the number of U.S. politicians that are talking openly about basically wanting to start a war with Russia. I think a lot of Americans have forgotten that when you go pick a fight with, Afghanistan or something, they're not very able to defend themselves. Russia is quite able to have a nuclear war, and I'm very concerned. They've threatened now. Russia has said that if the U.S. repeats something like the Tomahawk missile strike on Syria, which they felt was completely unjustified, that they would respond with force. We have Russia threatening to respond to the United States with military force. That scares the heck out of me. How do you see the situation, and where do you think it's headed from here?
No, in some ways I see a match between a checkers player and a three-dimensional chess player. No prizes for guessing which one I think is which. So I'm just hoping that whatever provocation happens to happen in Syria, which of course people who voted for Trump thought they wouldn't be needing to discuss anymore, that would have only happened under Hillary. I hope that whatever provocation, Putin is intelligent enough to completely outstep them. and ended strategically in his advantage without a large loss. That seems to be how he operates. And but again, you're dealing with a total wild card in terms of what's going to drive Trump's behavior and how much does that fit into what the military-industrial complex actually wants to do. And maybe they want a military strike there. But it is beyond the level how can you actually discuss global politics when it comes down to the ego level of a leader who is totally inexperienced in playing games on this scale versus one, of course, is incredibly experienced and has been quite successful for the last 20 years?
Let's go back to economics, probably a more refreshing. The massive explosion of debt in China that threatens to cripple the economy. Now, that's a pleasant topic compared to Russia and the United States. But you are an expert, of course, on debt and the problems that come from excessive debt. Kyle Bass has suggested that the situation with the explosion of leverage and debt in China since 2008 is setting up a situation that might force the Chinese to devalue the yuan in a massive way, potentially sending a wave of deflation around the world. And of course, there's a lot of different views as to whether or not that's realistic. How do you see this? Is that a realistic scenario that Mr. Bass paints, or is he completely out to lunch?
No, I think it's actually pretty much on the money there, because the only thing that got China through the crisis back in 2008 was an incredible increase in private credit. If you look at the first impact of the global financial crisis on China, it was something like about a 40% fall in its export volume very, very rapidly. And what that meant was that the factories, which are mainly along the coastal cities in China, were forced to lay people off. And when they laid them off, most of them didn't have work permits to actually be in those cities. They were forced back to the countryside. So the scale of political chaos that meant for China was enormous, and they had to get a rapid stimulus in there. Now, what they did was, because the state banks are pretty much actually government-owned banks, and also because in China, if an official tells you to do something, it's very good for your health to follow the instructions. So the level of credit in China as a percentage of GDP was about 20% when the crisis began. It fell, as it would have done because of the lack of demand for investment in that stage, towards 15%. And then the directive hit, and it went from 15% of GDP to 38% of GDP in 1 year. That was the increase in credit. Now, it's fallen back from that peak, but it's still, after peaking at almost 40% of GDP in 2010, it has never fallen below 20% of GDP, and it's now bouncing between 28% and 30% of GDP. That's given China, its debt level's gone from about 100% to 200% in just about 8 years, an enormous scale, one of the probably the biggest bubble in financial history in terms of the volume of money we're talking about here. Now, that's reaching, well past capacity. There are lots of loss-making ventures in China now, courtesy of that enormous level of leverage. And it has to end. You won't see China going much beyond reported level of, say, 225% of GDP is its private debt level. It's currently about 210. And when that happens, the credit-based demand disappears, and we're talking about demand equivalent to roughly one quarter of the size of the world's second largest economy. Now, that's huge. That's like $2.5 trillion of demand will disappear from the global economy as that decline in credit starts. And can the Chinese government counteract that with its own spending? Now, it's far more likely to move into that than any Western democratic nation, because they just simply don't face the legislative and parliamentary limits on their behaviour. And it's always been a centrally directed system. So to go back to government spending being the driving force is like returning to mama. So I can see them doing it, but they can't avoid a credit crunch in the meantime. Now, that means that in the next 1 or 2 years, you're likely to see a serious decline in China, comparable to what happened at the time of the global financial crisis itself, and then attempts to reverse it. And in that situation, the currency going down and the government actually trying to assist that along its way by selling its own currency, which it has enormous capacity to do, then you could see that deflationary shock come through the rest of the global economy starting around, say, 2020.
So it sounds like a credit crisis in China could indeed be the catalyst that might lead us to another financial crisis or another global systemic situation. That, of course, begs the much broader and overarching question of, can the world avoid another financial crisis? And it is, of course, timely that we ask you that question because you've just published a book by that exact title, Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis? That is available right now on Amazon in the UK only. And it sounds like about mid-May before it will be available for order through Amazon in the United States. We will get a email out in our weekly research roundup email. When it is possible to order that book in the United States, we'll send the Amazon link at that point to our listeners. So our U.S. listeners will have the ability to do it. But let's get a preview right now for those who aren't able to see the book yet. Can we avoid another financial crisis? Our listeners who have heard your prior interviews know the answer is no. But let's let's give them a little bit more for their money than that. Why is the answer no?
Okay, the answer is no because it's a complicated no. If it was a straightforward no, I would have written a two word book rather than a 25,000 word one. But the basic cause is that total demand in the economy is the sum of the turnover of existing money plus credit. Conventional economics tells you you can ignore credit. That's why they didn't see the financial crisis coming. It's why I did see it coming. Now, if that's the basis, the turnover of existing money plus credit is your source of total expenditure, which therefore becomes income, then if you have a rising level of private debt to income, at some point, for a range of reasons, and I elaborate these in the book, you then have people not willing to take on any more credit to the income level plateaus. And when it plateaus, credit, which is the change in debt, goes to zero. And of course, if you have people trying to pay their debts down or they're going bankrupt, then credit actually becomes negative. So what was a positive contribution to demand in the lead up, once you reach the saturation point, becomes either zero or negative. And America had that classic experience of going from credit being 15% of GDP to -5% over a 2-year period. Now, once you've done that, if you try to reduce your debt by paying it down, by earning more, by growing faster, yada, 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 you find you can't do that. And what then happens is each attempt to reduce your debt level by paying debt down actually destroys the money that you repay that debt with. And that reduction in capacity to spend reduces your income as almost as much or more in some cases, given large levels of deflation, reduces your income more than it reduces your debt level. So your debt ratio either remains constant or rises. And you can be stuck there without a little event like, for example, the Second World War. You can be stuck there indefinitely. Now, Japan gives us the best instance of that. Japan hit its crisis in 1990 because of the momentum of debt still rising and GDP actually falling at that stage. The debt ratio continued to rise till about 1992 or 3. It peaked at 225% of Japan's GDP. It's down to about 165%. So they've cut it by roughly a quarter. But that still gives it a debt level which is probably 1.5 times as much as that economy should be carrying. And therefore, nobody wants to borrow money for investment. Investment is less than it needs to be to cause the economy to grow or to have the firms being able to finance innovation, and the economy becomes stagnant. Now, America joined that same situation 18 years later with this crisis in 2008. Several other economies did the same thing. The Netherlands, obviously. Spain, very obviously. Ireland also. The UK, though it didn't actually realize it had done this. And they're all what I call the walking dead of debt. They're carrying so much debt, private debt, that they are not investing, they're not growing. They therefore stumble on with only one real source of demand, the more the turnover of existing money. And that, because of the situation of a long-running slump, that happens even more slowly again. So even that turnover slows down. So they're the walking dead of debt. But there are countries that appeared to get through the crisis in 2008 with flying colors, South Korea and Australia being the two most outstanding examples because they were the only two OECD nations not to record a technical recession, two consecutive quarters of negative growth. They got through it by increasing their leverage. So Australia's running at about, having hit about 180% when the crisis occurred, it's now about 210%. It's got the second most over-indebted households in the world. The only ones that beat them are the Swiss. And with that level of debt, they're going to hit a ceiling in the next 2 or 3 years, more likely the next 1 year for the housing sector. And that's the end of credit demand there. They'll go from being what I call they managed to cheat the crisis, but they're now what I call the zombies to be. And in terms of the countries identified, the major countries, China, obviously, Canada, almost certainly, South Korea, Australia, and then a range of unexpected countries like Belgium, Norway, Sweden, the Netherlands, and so on. The Netherlands has got the capacity to both be the walking dead of debt and a new zombie all at once.
Steve, you did your PhD thesis modeling Hyman Minsky's economic models, and you're obviously one of the leading experts in the world on this whole Minsky cycle. So what I'd like you to do is, first, for anybody who may not be familiar with Minsky's work, give us a quick overview of the Minsky model, but particularly what's always fascinated me, people talk about the so-called Minsky moment, when all of a sudden there's a tipping point and everything changes. What causes that boom-bust cycle to switch from boom to bust and that Minsky moment to be triggered? What, is there something that you can look for? Are there signals in the economy that tell us when it's coming? How do you know how to interpret this?
Yeah, good question. The starting point is that asking what question did Minsky ask himself that led to his hypothesis? And this is one thing I'll start the new book with by talking about the attitude that mainstream economists had to the economy, believing not only they understood how the economy operated, but they were managing it so well there would never be another crisis. And you're getting pronouncements like that up to and including June of 2007, 2 months before the crisis actually began. So Minsky, rather than the reason they reached that answer, by the way, was they thought the important economic question is, can we derive macroeconomic theory from microeconomics? That's what occupied the minds of so-called leading Nobel Prize-winning economists for the last 40 years. Minsky asked himself a completely different question. He posed it first really in the 1950s, and that was, can a Great Depression happen again? And if so, why hasn't one happened so far? And he's writing in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And to me, that was a far more sensible question to ask about capitalism. And having asked it, it makes you focus upon elements of the real world that the mainstream completely left out of their theories. So to make their theories more tractable, their simplistic 19th century mathematics they think is sophisticated, they left out the existence of money. Now, most people think economists must be experts on money. No, they persuaded themselves you can ignore money and model capitalism and derive your monetary variables as extension of the real phenomena you think are happening with money just being a veil over barter. So they left out money, they left out banks, they left out debt, and they therefore were completely blindsided when a crisis caused by money and banks hit them in 2007. But Minsky's perspective was to say, well, capitalism is inherently cyclical. Now, that itself is a shift, because the neoclassicals say capitalism is in equilibrium, which is not a capitalism I've ever experienced in my lifetime, but that's their vision. Start from equilibrium. Minsky said it's always cyclical. They then said, let's leave banks, debt, and money out. Minsky said banks, debt, and money are crucial. So he said, how do banks, debt, and money interact with an inherently cyclical nature of capitalism? And his idea was very, very simple. It's beautifully easy to portray, unlike neoclassical theory, which involves talking about utility curves and all this sort of nonsense. So Minsky said, take some point in history shortly after there's been a financial crisis when the economy appears to be doing okay in the aftermath. The longer you go from the crisis point itself, with tranquil economic conditions, the more people tend to forget the previous crisis and think, oh, thank God that's over, and then start to revalue assets on the basis of extrapolating forward this period of relative tranquility. And as they do that, they're more willing to borrow money. And when they borrow money, the extra money causes the economy to grow. And so there's a positive feedback between that change in expectations as you forget the previous crisis to growth. So what Minsky said was the fundamental instability of a capitalist economy is upward. The tendency to turn doing well into a speculative boom is the fundamental weakness of a capitalist economy. Now that is a very different vision, a critical vision of capitalism, which criticizes on the basis of one of its strengths. And that's not what the usual critics do. They normally focus on what they see as some sort of weakness. But Minsky said, no, because capitalism will both generate signals that give you an increasing desire to invest and provide you with the means to finance that investment, then it has this positive feedback loop, as engineers would describe it, that leads to a bubble forming out of a period of relative tranquility. So that's pretty much what you can see happening, say, back in from 1992 at the end of the last great recession before the really great one, and off you go on a bubble at that point. Now, what then happens is that as firms begin to borrow more money to invest, they cause the economy to grow more rapidly. That reduces unemployment. It also makes resources more essential, and the prices of labor and resources start to get bidden up. At the same time, as firms have taken on additional debt to finance investments, so their debt levels have gone up as well. So they're suddenly forking out more money to three other social groups: resource producers, workers, and bankers. And the rate of profit they were expecting to get when they began doing this investment is less than they anticipated. In fact, the increased costs of those three increased costs can actually eliminate their profit margins. So at almost the peak of the boom, they stop investing because they're losing money, or they're not getting the return they wanted. Investment slows down. That slowdown in investment finally translates through with a lag to the change in prices for commodities and for labor. And as that decline goes on now, as you go from a boom to a slump, and declining share going to workers and going to raw material resources, part of the return to bankers doesn't fall as much because it's based on the increase in debt that's come out of that bubble. So the debt level's risen. They're getting a larger share of income as the other two social classes see their share decline. And then when you get to it reaches a new point where the rate of return to capitalists has got back to the level that stimulated them to invest in the first place. But that now involves a larger share going to bankers and back to a smaller share going to workers and to raw material providers. So another boom takes off again, but it starts from a high level of private debt. So that keeps on happening several cycles. And you finally get to the point where there's such a level of private debt taken on, such a reduction in income going to workers in particular, and also prices for raw material suppliers, that when the boom starts and with this much, much higher level of debt, the increase in the share going to the raw material producers and the workers can eliminate that profit very rapidly. And therefore, at that point, firms again try to go through the same old process, but they owe so much money having accumulated all this debt compared to income through a series of booms and busts, they can't delever. They can't pay down their debt. And you go into a period where there's declining nominal debt, but rising ratio of debt to GDP, and you have a massive scale of bankruptcies wiping out that debt, or some government spending to make up for the decline in private cash flows, you have a Great Depression. And that's the Minsky moment. It's when you reach that point where so much is going to the bankers that what's left over for capitalists after they've paid their wages and their raw material costs is actually possibly negative, and the economy will just continue descending into a crisis.
If you look at the housing markets in Canada and Australia in particular, a lot of people feel that they're in bubbles and, you know, out of control in terms of excessive valuations. Certainly in some U.S. cities, that's true. San Francisco has seen just so much money coming out of China that their property values have been pushed way up. So what actually causes housing bubbles to pop? Is it just a relationship of personal income to affordability of debt service, or is it something else?
It's more complicated. I mean, the wild card of that enormous demand coming in from China is something which we haven't had to deal with before. And the scale of increase in profit, the scale of wealth that's been generated there is so great that people have got a strong encouragement to buy in what they see as politically safer areas, and also buy cities that actually have blue sky above them rather than smog everywhere. So that's an initial wild card. But the basic causal mechanism that drives house prices is actually mortgage debt. And this is why we get trapped by a little trick in mortgage debt, which leads the causation of house price bubbles forming and then also them bursting to be the opposite of what people actually think they are. So this is slightly hairy logic, but I'll see if I can talk it through in the radio. If you imagine what the monetary demand for housing is, it's fundamentally new mortgages. More than 90%, when you particularly get into a bubble, more than 90% of the money that's used to buy a house is borrowed money. That is new mortgage debt, which is therefore change in the level of existing mortgage debt. Now, if you want to convert that into what's the flow of demand per year for standardized houses, you divide that by the price index, so that new mortgages, which is change in mortgage debt, divided by the price level, gives you the number, the flow of demand for houses per year at one particular point in time. Similar thing I can do on the supply side, but I'll leave it at that for the demand side now. So you get a relationship between change in mortgage debt and the level of house prices. It takes a bit of mathematics to work it further than this, but the final punchline is that what causes rising house prices is change in mortgage credit, where mortgage credit is change in mortgage debt. So you get a relationship between acceleration of mortgage debt and change in house prices. And what it means is that you now have to look at the acceleration of mortgage debt to know when there's going to be a turning point in house prices. Now, here I'm going to get really hairy, so I hope people cope with this logic. If you imagine that there's some base level of mortgage debt to GDP, which is when there's a totally stable economy, you might have, say, the ratio of mortgage debt to GDP being, say, 20%. So mortgage debt is 20% of GDP. If you hit a peak level, America was below 100%, but let's just say the peak level is, say, 100% of GDP. Then if you connect the two over time, from the 20% low level to the 100% peak, you get a elevated S. And the slope of the slope of that S is the rate of change of mortgage debt. Now, that will peak halfway up the hill. If you're starting in the valley at 20%, rising to the plateau at 100%, then halfway up that slope is the maximum rate of growth of mortgage debt or change in new mortgages. But it's actually the acceleration that actually drives house prices. Now, the acceleration is the slope of that change in mortgage debt. The change in mortgage debt, if you have that S-slope shape for the ratio of mortgage debt to GDP, then the change in mortgage debt, the new mortgages will peak at the halfway point on the S-curve and then go down. So you've got a pimple there. Now, it's not the shape of the pimple that actually gives you the burst of house. It's the slope of the pimple itself. So the maximum point on that pimple, where you get this going up the hill and then coming back over in terms of the rate of change of mortgage debt, that's where house price changes peak. And that's the acceleration peak is before the change peak, which is before the plateau. So when that happens, you then have house prices start to fall. When house prices start to fall, that discourages people from taking out more mortgage debt. That means the amount of demand being created in the overall economy by credit, mortgage credit, declines. And with that decline, you set off a decline in total demand, and that causes the rise in unemployment. So this is one reason why asset markets tend to move ahead of the physical economy. It's because of the acceleration is what drives asset markets, whereas change is what drives the real economy. So when the housing bubbles burst, as they did in America, for example, in 2006, it's sometime after that that the economy itself falls over. And Canada, Australia, South Korea, Norway, by the looks of it, Sweden quite possibly, Belgium are all going to repeat that experience in the next 1 to 3 years.
Okay, if we look right now at the U.S. housing market, we're actually seeing that the price levels have turned around. We're seeing a recovery in U.S. housing prices, but it's happening at a time when mortgage debt is actually falling. So is that because of this acceleration ratio that we're seeing what seems like a counterintuitive relationship?
And that's why it's so tricky, because if you imagine you use a car to think about how do you handle acceleration versus velocity, your acceleration can be falling as you are getting your velocity is rising because you're reaching the maximum speed the car can actually do. So we have this period where there can be acceleration is still positive. You are going faster per unit of time than you were beforehand, but you're going faster more slowly. So you can have rising velocity with declining acceleration. Then on the other side, if you are now tapering down, and this is the state for the new mortgages in America, you can have the level of new mortgages falling, but falling more slowly and therefore accelerating. So it's really quite a tricky dynamic. And if you then do this analysis, which I've done, and I'm publishing a paper on this front, I hope next year, with Paul Omerund and a guy called Rickard, who's our econometrician, we've done the causal relationship using very limited but nonetheless indicative linear mathematics called Granger causality. We've shown that it's acceleration of mortgage debt causes a change in house prices, not the other way around. When you graph it for America, as I've done on my Prof. Steve Keen website, you'll see it looks like there's no relationship you can really discern between the level of mortgage debt and the level of house prices. When you look at the acceleration of mortgage debt and the change in house prices, it's almost like you've got a hand inside a glove. They fit so well. And at the moment, mortgage debt in America is accelerating, even though its ratio to debt to GDP, mortgage debt is flatlining, only slightly rising, and that's what's giving you the rise in house prices. And they have actually gone past the previous peak.
Wow. Well, Steve, every interview with you is like drinking economics from a fire hose, is the metaphor that I use. But I want to ask you a question on a totally different topic, because I really enjoy your perspective and how down-to-earth and connected to reality your views are, and as opposed to the neoclassical economics crowd that doesn't seem to be in touch. But I was actually shocked watching the Real Vision television interview where you were on the other side of the microphone interviewing Dr. Michael Hudson, who also is a PhD in economics. In theory, the two of you guys, you're both PhDs, you're kind of representatives of academia in a sense. At one point, Hudson quips that he basically has his PhD because it's the union card, as he put it, that you need to be taken seriously. But he goes on to say that he learned nothing useful in studying for his PhD, and everything useful that he knows he learned by actually working in financial markets. And I know that you've had some very outspoken views that neoclassical economists are just not in touch with reality. What is the root cause here? How is it possible that academic finance could be so out of touch with the real world? And what's the cause, and how could we fix it?
Well, it really goes back to ideology and 19th century contests over capitalism versus socialism. Because when you had, if you wanted to swing the praises of capitalism these days, you'd sing the capacity of capitalism to innovate. That's clearly the advantage it had over the Soviet system. But when you go back to the 19th century, Marx was criticizing capitalism on the basis of exploiting workers, taking the previous classical theory as the basis for doing that. The neoclassicals began in the 1870s. They stole some ideas from earlier researchers or earlier ideologues back in the early 1800s, particularly Jean-Baptiste Say, but also Corno. They argued that capitalism is all about maximizing the utility of people, and it's all about reaching equilibrium. And they left out to actually do the mathematics to try to work out whether a multi-market system could reach equilibrium on its own. Vollrar left out non-equilibrium trades, left out money, etc., etc. But what he saw was the vision of a perfectly self-regulating economy with no concentration of power and no need for coercion. Now, fundamentally, that's a vision of an anarchist society. It's saying the market is the ultimate anarchist governing system. You don't need politicians, you don't need regulations, you don't need compulsion. Leave it to the market, the law reaches lovely equilibrium. And that becomes a beautiful, seductive vision for young, particularly male, nerdish men who end up going into doing an economics degree. And they actually love that vision. They become dedicated to it. They really become zealots for that vision of capitalism rather than analysts of what actually exists as capitalism. And given that nature, they drive out anything which is an alternative perspective. So if you read Schumpeter, who talks about the instability of capitalism, if you read the evolutionary economists in general, if you read Marx in particular, you get a vision of capitalism they don't like, and they drive that vision out. So what you get is inculcation of a vision based on an incredibly stylized model which emphasizes stability and equilibrium as the strong major attractions of capitalism, when in fact instability and innovation are its main features and strengths. And that religion is what you learn if you do a university degree. You only learn the other stuff if you go looking in the netherworld. You look for the people and the bookshelves in economics they don't put onto the reading lists, and that's where you find the good value. I was a bit luckier than Michael. I had a brilliant historian of economic thought called Ted Wheelwright, who was my lecturer in my third year as undergraduate, and just exposed me to this enormous range of writing that I hadn't learned through my mainstream courses, and I then read further in that area. Michael, in a similar sense, got a couple of leads. In particular, in America's case, learned about the original protectionist lobby in America, which really was their success in policies, really why America managed to industrialize so well in the 19th century, and he learned that literature. So we taught ourselves out of school, so to speak. And anybody who gets taught in school and swallows the stuff is lost to reality.
Well, it's really depressing that if you want to learn all about economics that relate to the real world, it's so hard to learn that from the university system. But I'm very, very interested to know more about what you're doing, because I think you described yourself as perhaps the world's first crowdfunded economist with the new work that you're doing to basically provide economics education on Patreon. So please tell our listeners what that project is about.
Yeah, well, it's really quite funny. I think in some ways we're finally winning the war over the theory of capitalism with the failure of the neoclassicals and the success of the non-orthodox monetary non-equilibrium approach that I take and that Michael also takes. But as we're winning the war, we're losing one of the crucial battles, and that is that the only way that non-orthodox economics has survived the push that's been pushed by the mainstream over the last 40 years is we get jobs in the low-ranked universities where they couldn't be bothered getting positions anyway. So ironically, if you want to get a good education in economics, go to a poorly rated university. Places like the University of Utah, for example, University of Missouri, Kansas City, the American ones I'm using here, the New School for Social Research, University of Massachusetts Amherst. Those are about the only places you'll get a non-conventional education in economics in America. Now, what's happened in the English, in the Anglo world, Australia and England in particular, is that neoliberal policies have dominated education reform, and I actually think a better word for reform is deform. And these policies have said, well, let's turn university into a marketplace. So what they've done, what they did first of all in Australia back in 2012, and they repeated in England in 2014, was that there were controls set by the bureaucrats on how many positions each university could offer for humanities subjects, science subjects, and so on. And in an attempt to make it, inverted commas, more like a market, the bureaucrats said, let's abolish those controls and let universities decide how many positions they want to offer. Now, a market, to be a genuine market, requires informed consumers. High school students are the ones who buy university degrees. They haven't got a clue what a university is about. They're only ever going to buy one in their lives. They haven't sampled 500 to know they prefer Shiraz to Pinot Grigio. You know, they haven't got become informed consumers at all. So their response to that was to say, oh, if a high-ranked university offers me a position, it must be better than the lower-ranked university. So what that meant was the tenuous hold on academic positions that non-orthodox thinkers like I had in universities like Kingston was eliminated, and because students were poached by the higher-ranked universities in the UK. So our Kingston's intake has gone from 22,000 students to 15 over a 3 or 4 year period. It's now financially stretched, can't afford the expense of having me do my public intellectual role in economics. So I faced either four times the teaching load, which would eliminate my capacity to extend the theory and to educate the public, or I had to find my three quarters of my own salary. So I'm doing that with Patreon, and the intention ultimately is to build an online education service of people who really want to learn about economics from a non-orthodox point of view and don't have time to go to university and won't go, of course, to the low-ranked ones anyway. So I intend setting up an online, what I'm calling Keen, online realistic economics program using Patreon. And it's off to a reasonable start. I've got about one third of the way that I need to go before I can become completely independent of the university sector. And then beyond that, start developing my Minsky software, and beyond that, start hiring other members of the non-orthodox community to really, really teach economics extremely well and critically on the web.
Well, I think that's an absolutely fantastic idea. I think the entire university system should be replaced by web-based online learning that relates to the real world. So I think you're doing pioneering work, and I'm very excited to check it out myself. Unfortunately, we are out of time, so let's go very quickly. The website is profstevekeen.com. We'll have a link in the Research Roundup email to that. The book is Can We Avoid Another Financial Crisis by Professor Steve Keen, available now in the UK only, soon to be available in the rest of the world. We'll get a link to the order page on Amazon as soon as it's available to the rest of the world. And for the new online education through Patreon, what's the URL, Steve, in order for our listeners to find out more?
The usual www.patreon.com/profstevekeen.
Steve, I can't thank you enough for another fantastic interview, and we look forward to getting you back on the program in a few months. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, What a great interview with Professor Keane. What were your thoughts on the interview?
Well, you know, Patrick, the thing that was most striking to me is clearly Professor Keane is fed up with the establishment educational system. It sounds like this campaign he's doing on Patreon, he basically wants to go into the business of selling economic education online to the general public rather than doing it through the university system. And my hat is off to him. I think he's an absolutely brilliant, brilliant guy. I do think that his view is not the only view. Certainly, I have respect for Austrian economists. Professor Keane is not in the Austrian camp. He's in a slightly different camp, but he's plugged into reality as opposed to the neoclassical nonsense that they teach in universities. So that's gotten us to thinking, boy, wouldn't it be cool to put together at least one, maybe several shows where we're not doing the news of the day as we usually do on this program, but we might have Professor Keane actually give some economics classes, some lectures, if you will, on the program, and we could use those for holiday weeks or something like that. So Patrick and I are working, folks, on that. We welcome your suggestions, but we'd really like to, if Professor Keane wants to go in the business of selling economics education online, we'd love to give him a place to showcase his work and maybe put some teaser content out that will help him with his sales. And we certainly encourage you to check out what he's doing on Patreon. The other thing, though, that really made me think of you, and I wanted to follow up with you on this, Patrick, is his comments on Canadian real estate. I've been watching Canadian and Australian real estate, and I definitely think that these markets are both completely out of control. And I think that flight capital, or I shouldn't say flight capital, it's really dirty money leaking out of China, is what's driving it. Now, you live in Canada, so you've got a lot more insight on this. How do you see the situation with Canadian real estate?
Well, Eric, I really enjoyed Professor Steve Keen's work because I'm a really big fan of Hyman Minsky. And I think the situation when you look at the Minsky models really is very relevant when looking at Canada. And one of the core aspects or tenets of the Minsky model is the idea that stability breeds instability. And when you look at Canada and the Canadian economy, it has been the beacon of stability and resiliency when through all the financial crisis and everything, the Canadian economy held up like a rock. And this has bred a culture of complacency in Canada. There's this that embedded psyche in the average Canadian that real estate only goes up and you can't lose money in real estate. You just have to see it through. That culture is now really ingrained over here.
Okay, hang on, Patrick, because when you're talking about this, what specifically is causing you to say this? Is it because of what you're seeing in prices? Is it because what you're seeing in the behavior of individuals around you? What are the signals that are telling you that we have this condition of just reckless bullishness in real estate in Canada?
Well, you know, Eric, I had the opportunity of being a part of the tech bubble in 99, as well as the gold and silver bubble. And I look at today in the Toronto real estate market. I can only reference Toronto because that's where I am located. But there was a story several months ago where there was a builder that was putting out a townhouse complex. And the builder basically was having the grand opening. They came to the office with his team and essentially, they came and there was a lineup of hundreds of people going around the block to get a piece of this action. So what did the builder do? He turned around and literally told everyone that they're delaying the opening by several hours. They went literally into the office and they reprinted everything, bumping the prices up several hundred thousand dollars on all of these townhouses, reopened and still sold out. You know, and I listened to that story and it reminds me when I was back just getting into this industry back in the late 1990s, I remember the lineups of people waiting to open up brokerage accounts so that they could buy Nortel shares. You know, the lineups at TD and RBC to just get a piece of that action. And then I think back to the lineups I've seen of people waiting to buy gold and silver at the different bullion dealers in 2011. And I can't help but to feel and see that this feels the same as that.
Boy, it reminds me of a story when I was living in Hong Kong in 2009 and 10 at the peak of that real estate bubble, right around the corner from where I lived. There's this, it's now a famous story. It's called 39 Conduit Road. Condos, just like you're saying, all of a sudden the word was out that these things are selling like hotcakes. They're selling above their asking price. You got to get one. And the stops came out. Wealthy people from China were smuggling money in from Macau, and they would pay anything for a piece of 39 Conduit Road, any price. It ended up being the most expensive residential real estate ever sold in the history of the world on a per square foot basis. Several months later, it came out that all of those early sales were totally bogus. It was friends of the builders, and it was all just set up as a con, and everybody fell for it. And it was, you know, an entire building sold out for about double what it was worth. So it sounds like you're in that crazy bubble stage in Canada with Canadian real estate right now. But let's go back to what happened in the United States. You had years of being in that condition. It's not until there's a proximal trigger, some kind of catalyst that pops the bubble. In the case of the United States, it was in the second quarter of 2007, a whole bunch of adjustable rate mortgages all resetting at once, and that caused that trigger that basically popped the bubble. So what would be the equivalent trigger, or have you figured that out yet? What do you see coming? How will you know when the bubble is bursting in Canadian real estate?
Well, this is why I really admire Keane's work, is because to me, the real estate turn was not going to be this moment where the average Canadian reaches this rational moment, said, you know, that's enough. I can't pay any more or a higher price for the houses. I always believed that this was going to be a credit or liquidity event. And this is where right now we had a very interesting thing happening here in Canada, which is the situation with Home Capital Group, which was one of the biggest secondary mortgage dealers in Canada. It's sort of, some people are calling it the new century moment in Canada. And so one of the reasons why house prices were so flush with liquidity, not only was this big flood of foreign capital coming in, but essentially this very robust shadow banking market and secondary mortgage market existed, getting people approved for mortgages that would normally never be approved by the Main Street banks. And this has allowed that liquidity imbalance in supply and demand to really drive prices. And so now with the Home Capital basically running into this massive liquidity event, they had to raise capital, billions of dollars, at a 22% interest rate. Essentially, they're on the path to some form of bankruptcy or restructuring at this stage. But this has more or less killed the liquidity for almost all of these secondary mortgage dealers, because now for them to raise the high interest savings accounts and term deposits that they need to run their businesses, they're now going to be far more challenged in being able to raise that capital. And this, with the fact that the Ontario government has now implemented 15% foreign ownership tax and all the rules in Canada for how to get approved for mortgages has increased, we're now seeing a real shift of what it would take for someone to borrow money. But the real question, and I think that what you're trying to get at, is when is that turning point? Well, this is now a liquidity event, but it has not yet become a credit event. But a liquidity event can very easily morph into a credit event. And this is really where the next few months are going to be so important to watch how this continues to evolve. Because if we see that it's very difficult for people to get mortgages, and that entire liquidity and capital access that was so flush with liquidity disappears, that could become the catalyst for a turning point over the next 3 to 6 months.
Okay, so you're saying that the 15% taxes that have been imposed in Vancouver and Toronto, that's going to take a lot of demand out of the market for the cash buyers, the money sneaking out of China to park it in Canadian real estate because they like Canada better because it's easier to get the visa to go to Canada than the United States if you're in China. That money is going to dry up in terms of buyers. At the same time, it's going to be harder for less qualified buyers to get financing. Now, the thing is, these factors are going to start to slow the purchases, but I would argue that credit event you're talking about probably doesn't happen until you get to the point where there's mortgages underwater, where the prices have started to go down and you've got more people defaulting and walking away from their mortgage because the mortgage is underwater and they owe more than the house is worth. So what are the typical ratios? Do you have to have a large down payment in Canada, or do you have the craziness that we have in the United States of 2% or 5% down mortgages? And at what point does this become a risk for the banks? Is there a short on banks here? And also, is there another way to play this? If you know, in the U.S. where there were securitized mortgages, you could look at credit default swaps on those mortgage vehicles. Is that a play, or is it just the shorts on the banks?
Yeah, Eric, the mortgage market in Canada is definitely different, and we haven't had the securitization or these ARMs mortgages, and so we don't have the same catalysts and the same way that you can play it. In Canada, we have a far different system. We have the CMHC, which is a government-sponsored mortgage insurance company, and essentially what we've done in Canada is socialized mortgage risk, which it literally lets the banks off the hook of the risk of who they lend to. And this actually, while it was certainly one of the reasons people argue that we've had so much stability in Canada, but basically back to that same Minsky quote, that stability potentially has bred the instability that we're seeing today. Nonetheless, these Canadian banks are not going to be badly hurt on the first wave of any defaults, because much of the risk is going to be absorbed by all the insurance on these mortgage defaults. So where the banks will get hurt is from the contagion, economic contagion that comes from it. What you want to think is the Canadian economy is unique in a way that it only is driven primarily by two key parts of the economy. It's by our resource-based, commodity-driven part of our economy, and the fact that real estate plays such a huge driver in jobs and building and economy. And so if we have the scenario where commodity prices are declining and the commodity markets are under pressure, at the same time we have a slowdown in real estate where all the builders stop building, people can't flip, real estate agents stop making as much money, we could start seeing unemployment rising. We could start seeing the economy substantially slowing. And that's where the real risk to the bank stocks come in, because that's where all the periphery lending, credit card defaults, line of credit defaults, the lending substantially slows down. Corporations start to borrow less, and the whole thing can start a credit cycle. But to kind of sum that up, I think shorting Canadian bank stocks might be a little bit early, because we're only seeing the first cracks in the armor, like we've suggested in the U.S., where real estate peaked in late 2006, early 2007, and even a new century occurred in April of 2007. You didn't see a Bear Stearns or a Lehman Brothers until late into 2008, but it really was just a process of the situation eroding. And I think really we may very well just be beginning that stage of seeing that rollover and the erosion and the price prices peaking out. So to kind of answer that, I think that it's still kind of early to play it.
Okay, so it sounds like we're still in the beginning of 2007 in this story for Canada, and probably the move is to think about that bank short after you've seen this thing really start to happen, and when that contagion risk comes to fore. We'll certainly keep our listeners abreast of any developments in coming weeks and months here on Macro Voices. I know also that this is exactly what you teach. This kind of conversation is a sample of what you teach in your macro trading course at bigpicturetrading.com. So I want to encourage any listeners who would like more of this kind of content to check out bigpicturetrading.com and what's on offer there. Meanwhile, we need your help promoting the show. We've got some really amazing guests coming up in the next few weeks. The reason that we've been able to get these really big names is because we're finally getting enough registered users at macrovoices.com that Patrick is able to use that statistic of how many users and how many accredited investors in particular we have in our database in order to recruit these high-profile guests. So please retweet us when we announce the show. Forward your research roundup emails to your friends and colleagues colleagues. And most importantly, please register your free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email. Never contains marketing or advertising. It's just a compendium of links to all of the coolest free stuff that we could find each week on the internet. Patrick, what's in this week's research roundup?
Well, the first thing that our listeners will find is the transcript for today's interview. In addition to that, I put in a link for a blog post from Variant Perception where they were talking about reflation is in danger due to low liquidity. There's also a link to a Jeffrey Snyder article titled A Case Study in Depression and Denial. But the one part that I want all of our listeners to really go check out is a great 10-minute Bloomberg interview with Kyle Bass talking about China's wealth management products. I really enjoyed it, and I think our listeners will too. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. And for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, please send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will include it in our weekly distributions. Now, if you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the latest and most recent updates. As well, you can follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com. And we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.